Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Imagine going to a really large museum like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, for example. 90% of the objects that you'll find in there were not made to be works of art.
Is anything beautiful art?
If a toilet can be art, can't anything be art?
By and large, an object has to differ interestingly from other objects of its kind.
Our guest, Alexander Naumas from Princeton University.
What is it about some things that sort of lifts them from their context and allows them to have a life that is independent of the original intention or the original use for which they were designed?
But is it art?
If it's music, it's supposed to have a tune. If it's painting, it's supposed to look like something. If it's a novel, it's supposed to have a plot. It's not a really good idea to begin discussing art by trying to define it.
What is art? Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from there, they migrate to the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And you can also now listen to the best of Philosophy Talk anywhere, anytime by downloading one of our podcasts.
Well, I don't know about you, Ken, but my teaching has been getting in the way of my blogging lately, but I'll try to do better
soon.
Yeah,
me too.
Today we're going to talk about art. Now, let me go back to about the time when I grew up in the 1800s.
Oh, John.
It was pretty simple what art was then. I mean, if it was music, it was supposed to be pleasant and arouse emotions, or pretty at any rate. If it was visual art, it was supposed to be look like something. If it was a novel, it was supposed to be fiction and be interesting. And art wasn't conceived as some kind of crossword puzzle that it took your brain years to figure out what the guy was trying to do. It was supposed to produce instantly some kind of pleasure in you. What happened?
Well, a lot of things have happened, and art has become a multifarious, multiple thing with all different kinds of things standing as art that you wouldn't, that older generations like you would not think, that's art? How could that be art? How could a toilet bowl be art?
In my day, when you wanted to see a toilet bowl, you went to the men's room. You don't go to a museum. I mean, come on. Isn't it just gobbledygook, a big way of getting a lot of rich people to pay a lot of money to hang stuff on their walls that doesn't make any sense?
Look, John, you're worried that some things that you wouldn't have, before you wouldn't have counted it as art, now count as art. But I think you have a fetish for essence or something like that. You're looking for necessary and sufficient conditions. That's the philosopher in you. I mean, art is more like a family resemblance concept. Think about what is a game. If you wanted to answer what's a game, I mean, it's all kinds of different things are games.
You're bringing Wittgenstein in here to help me with the question, what is art? That is it kind of one philosophical boondoggle to help with another artistic boondoggle. Come on, tell me what it is. What is it to be art?
Okay, I'll tell you. Look at it from two different perspectives. There's the artistic process, right? This is some creative, imaginative process that produces a product. And what is that product supposed to do? A consumer of it is supposed to observe, engage, encounter that product and have some kind of delight or some kind of enlightenment. So, you know, if the outcome of the artistic process is some product that a consumer is supposed to consume, and if it all works well, then it's great. And since consumers like all kinds of different things and the producer's imagination works in all kinds of different ways, it's not surprising that art is multifarious and diverse.
Well, so what makes a process an artistic process? If it's a painter and he's trying to paint a landscape or a portrait, that looks artistic. If he's walking across a piece of canvas on the floor dribbling paint, is that an artistic process? Oh, I forgot. It's a family resemblance concept,
right.
And there's no real saying anything about it that's intelligible to a finite mind like mine.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's consult an expert, somebody who knows more about art than you and I do. And our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out and found such an expert. She files this report.
I know I'm not the only person who's puzzled over a museum exhibit and thought, I could have done that. What's it doing here? To help me think about what art is, I paid a visit to Julie Charles, Associate Curator of Education at San Francisco's Museum of Modern Art. She told me,
when I knew that we were going to talk today, I actually started asking people, so what's art? And got great responses that run the gamut from, well, I know it when I see it, to, I think there's art everywhere, but everything's not art. So I'm not sure that there is a pat response to that question, but it's certainly a question that we're interested in exploring.
Okay, so if people know art when they see it, what kind of art appeals to most people?
Beginner viewers, which frankly is most of the population, like art with recognizable subject matter. For example, Diego Rivera's Flower Carrier painting is extremely popular. They know the name a little bit, it's recognizable subject matter. If they spend some time looking at the piece, they can kind of figure out what the story or the narrative is, and they feel very comfortable there. And then when they round the corner and they come to Rauschenberg's all-white painting is when everything falls apart, and that's when they say, why is this here, and an all-white painting shouldn't be in the museum, and that doesn't show skill and technique, and I don't get it.
Maybe art fools us into thinking it's easy to do.
One of the things we find with adult visitors is they'll say, oh, you know, my child could do that. Right. We also tour kids through the museum, and what's great is they say the exact same thing. I could do that. And yet there's this difference in the way that it's said. I personally went to see a David Ireland exhibit at the Oakland Museum, and one of them was a solid black work that was just all crayon, and I went home deciding that I was going to do that myself. And it's extremely hard to make a David Ireland with black crayons, and I went through at least four crayons before I gave up because it just didn't have the same look as what David Ireland did. So sometimes things look like they're so easy, and they're so not once you get home and you start trying it yourself.
I asked Julie Charles to take me to a work of art in the museum that really pushes people's buttons.
This is Jeff Koons, Michael Jackson and Bubbles, and it's an over life-size sculpture that sits on a pedestal showing Michael Jackson sitting with his pet monkey Bubbles on his lap. They're both wearing band uniforms. It's made out of porcelain, and so one of the things you notice right away is this beautiful shiny finish. The uniforms are gold and white, but you also notice, too, that then their skin is also that porcelain white. And I think that this is one of the issues that Jeff Koons is playing with, is our notions of race and identity. Jeff Koons didn't even make the piece himself. He sent it out to be fabricated, and I think that's something that people have a hard time with, because where's the craft? Where's the creativity?
Who's responsible for the idea that anything an artist does is art?
The person that came to my mind was Marcel Duchamp, who in 1912, 1913 made one of his very first ready-mades. And the ready-mades were everyday objects, so a bicycle wheel or a stool or a urinal. And he took these objects out of their everyday context and put them in a new context, what he called an art context, and said that by changing their context and by the fact that he was an artist himself and chose these objects, they were therefore transformed into art. And in doing so, opened up Pandora's box in terms of what art could be, what it could be made of, who even had to make it.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that very interesting piece. That was our roving philosophical reporter. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Alexander Nehemas, an old friend of Philosophy Talk. He's professor in the humanities, philosophy, and comparative literature at Princeton University. He's author of many books, including The Art of Living, Socratic Reflections from Plato to Foucault. Alexander, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Good afternoon, Ken. Good afternoon, John. Delighted to be with you again.
Hi, Alexander. Great to have you here again.
Hi.
So I've got a question for you.
Art, I can hear.
Art has been around for a long time. Right. There's art on prehistoric caves. How long have philosophers like me been confused about the nature of art? And philosophers like you asked and intelligently probed the question, what is art? And what is it? What are the theories? And which one of them do you like?
Well, John, I think philosophers have been interested in the question about as long as the rest of the world, even normal people, I would say. The question, what is art, did not come up as a question until Leo Tolstoy, at the very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, wrote a little book called What is Art? That's the first time that I know, at least, where the question actually became a serious one. Up to about the middle of the 19th century, it simply didn't exist because, as you said so correctly before, if it's music, it's supposed to have a tune. If it's painting, it's supposed to look like something. If it's a novel, it's supposed to have a plot and fiction. And they're all together pleasant. And all of a sudden, art started not being that or stopped being that. And now, that was a great crisis.
Now, Tolstoy thought it was the communication of emotion or something like that. Was that a good theory?
Well, not really. For one thing, he only allowed the emotions, the basic emotions of Christianity, which excludes a tremendous number of works, including most of his own. So he actually disowned War and Peace and Anna Karenina and everything else that he wrote, with the exception of a few short stories that have a Christian message. Wow. His idea was that art should promote universal brothership and only that.
Oh, wow. But let me ask you a question. Okay, I don't want a history lesson so much. I want to know what art is. So you tell me, what is art?
Yeah. Well,
Fessa.
I was going to turn the question on you and say, did you know when people started worrying about it? But I've already done that, so I can't. I think that it is an extraordinarily complicated question. And furthermore, I think it's not a really good idea to begin discussing art by trying to define it.
Why not? Because
I think if we ever get a definition of art, which I very much doubt, we're only going to get it after a tremendous amount of thinking about the various practices and institutions and objects that are classified as objects of art, as art objects in the world.
So let me take you back to the thing I said early on then. I mean, because it sounds like you might agree with me, and I might have been wiser than I thought, that, you know, art is stuff that's the outcome of some kind of process, I'm not quite sure, some kind of process of creating, imagining, right? And with the end in view of trying to get a consumer of it to have certain reactions, and the reactions can be multifarious, I mean, all kinds of different reactions you might.
Sure.
And art is whatever is the outcome of that process, good art anyway, whatever is a good outcome of that process and whatever does this thing to the consumer of it that it's intended to do. And there might be no one thing, you know, no one thing you could say about that other than something like that.
Well, that sounds very Wittgensteinian and profound, but it also sounds to me very circular. I mean, you know, you're saying, well, art is this complicated thing that has to do with what artists do and what art consumers consume and what we call art. Well, I mean, fine, but what is all that?
Well, look and see.
Well, wait a minute, gentlemen. Wait a minute. Ken says that it comes out of a process that is intended to produce a work of art. But think about it for a minute. Let's stop and think about it. Imagine going to a really large museum like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, for example. 90% of the objects that you'll find in there were not made to be works of art. They're made to be funerary pieces, like most of Egyptian art that we have today. They were jars to have olive oil and wine, which is what much of the Greek art that we have today is. They're objects for religious veneration and only religious veneration, and so on and so forth. In fact, I'd say that most of the art that we are aware of today was not produced to be art. It was produced to be something else.
Well, but okay, I take your point, and that sounds like a pretty decisive refutation of half of what I said.
Right.
But then we consume it under the aspect of art. We don't say,
we do.
Oh, this is just a utilitarian tool to be used in this or that ceremony for this or that purpose. We have this aesthetic
Absolutely.
Kind of engagement with it. Right.
And that's where I think the serious and interesting and important questions come in. The question is, what is it about some things that sort of lifts them from their context and allows them to have a life that is independent of the original intention or the original use for which they were designed? Because I think that, to a very great extent, is what characterizes art objects. And one of the features that I would consider there, it's, again, not a very informative way to look at it, but it might help a bit, is that to be an art object, by and large, and we'll have to qualify that in a minute, by and large, an object has to differ interestingly from other objects of its kind. In other words, a comb that has a comb that is completely simple and has no decoration whatsoever is not going to be as likely to be kept in a museum of art as a comb which is actually sculpted out of ivory.
Alexander, I'm gonna ask you to expand on that a little bit more in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today, what is art? Our guest, Alexander Nehemas from Princeton University.
We've been talking about the nature or essence or lack thereof of art. We're going to move into the difference between so-called high art, like you see in galleries and museums, and low art, like you see in the funny papers and on TV. And we'd like your thoughts about all this.
And you can join us by calling 415-841-4134. If you have the misfortune of being outside the Bay Area, you can still join us. 1-800-525-9917. High art, low art, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Trouble with an impressionist? He looks at a log. He doesn't know who he is standing, staring at this log. And surrealist memories are too amorphous and proud. While those downtown macho painters are just alcoholic.
John Cale and Lou Reed, The Trouble with Classicists. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and I love that song. Our topic today, what is art? What do you think art is? Is Seinfeld art? Is a toilet bowl, if it's placed in the museum, does that make it art? Tell us your thoughts. The number, 415-841-4134.
That's 415-841-4134, or outside the Bay Area, toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. Finally, email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Alexander Nehemas from Princeton University. Alexander, before the break, you were talking about you have to be distinctive, different from other objects of your kind in order to count as an art object. Just tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, think about it. Suppose that you are you're making. Let's stay with the idea of the comb that we were using before. Suppose that you're making combs, and some of them are extremely simple. They may even come out of some kind of mass-producing machine, but some of them you use special materials for. You spend time carving a design on the back where there is more material that you can use. You're making it stand out. You're making it slightly special.
Yeah.
And I think that desire to make things special, in that sense of special, is, I think, one of the moving forces behind art. You don't need to think of it as a work of art. You just want to make it stand out among whatever it is that you're doing.
But a piece of music, help me think about a piece of music in that way, standing out from other pieces of music. I mean, it's not art unless it's an amazing piece of music. What about the mediocre piece of music? Isn't that just art but not good art?
To a very great extent, especially about in music, where you know you really do have to be acting specifically for the purpose of creating music, great music is the music that stands out. Mediocre music is music that doesn't stand out as much. But actually, when you think about how few of the pieces of music that have ever been composed we are aware of, how little we have of all the efforts of countless thousands, millions of people who've tried to compose something or other, we are dealing with the cream of the cream of the cream of the cream. So it's very difficult to say, well, look, there are all those other things that had no character, because the things that have no character disappear.
There's a little bit difference in the way we use art. With the visual arts, we tend to call any sculpture or painting art, and it might be really bad art. With some of the other fields, we kind of say, well, that really rises to the level of art. That's there is that. Let me read two definitions that have come in by email. I like both, although they're not at all consistent with each other. This is from Larry, and Larry says, I like this broad definition of art. Art is the realization in the material world of a bright idea in a human mind. And he goes on a bit. He says, the advantage of this definition is reasonably objective and clear-cut. Sunsets, wildflower meadows are the workings of the human body artistic. I don't consider to be artistic. Now, here's the other definition, a little bit more cynical. This is from Joe. Capital A art, as applied to plastic artifacts that can be bought and sold, is the name of a market system that deals in a particularly durable investment vehicle. It was created along with the Parisian salon system and survived that system's demise. Like a stock or a bond, the work of art functions as a vehicle in which one can deposit capital in the hopes that it will accrue value over time and is a freely alienable, susceptible evaluation and fungible. Unlike stocks and bonds, however, art is not a stake in some larger project like a corporation or municipality. So two rather different definitions, both, I would say, rather insightful.
Very interesting, both of them. I like the first one because it's very simple. And it has the advantage of actually showing both its strength and perhaps, if Larry doesn't mind my saying so, its weakness. Namely, how do we decide what is a bright idea and what isn't? I mean, we can discuss that and we can have real disagreements. So if you think that something is bright, you, for example, you two disagreed about family resemblances versus essences before. You, John, may think that family resemblance is not a bright idea at all. So if a work of art expressed that idea, would you consider it a work of art or not, if you think the idea is not a good one? So there is, in other words, the definition shows us where the issue is. There's always something that is left a little outside the area of agreement, and that's where all the interest of the artistic definition, I think, is.
Hey, Alexander, I'm going to take you to high art, low art for a second, and then we've got a flood of callers that I'm going to try to get in here. But
okay.
You know, you said in Pat, a lot of the things we think of as art were made not to be art, but for some ordinary, some purpose, maybe some high purpose, maybe some low purpose. I mean, some people think of art as kind of high culture. You know, stuff you go to fancy museums to see, stuff that hangs in rich people's houses, stuff that people get really dressed up to go listen
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
What about, you know, Seinfeld? I mean, radio broadcasts and all that kind of stuff, TV shows.
Well, philosophy talk is certainly a work of art, I should say.
Thank you. Thank you.
No issue there.
I wasn't fishing for that.
No, of course not. But the truth is that, as I was saying before, I think the same point can be made again, that most of the art that we have today was not only not created to be art, but to the extent that it had something to do with art or entertainment or pleasure or enjoyment or getting the reaction that Ken was talking about before, was much closer to popular art and popular entertainment than what we consider the fine arts today. And the prime example of that, in my mind, is Greek tragedy, which is today one of the high points of artistic culture. Aeschylus and Sophocles, Euripides, they are the standards by which we judge theater and drama and everything. I am convinced that when Plato in the Republic, setting up his ideal city, said, there won't be any such thing in our city. There won't be any dramatic or epic poetry. Not even Homer would be in Plato's ideal city. What he had in mind was the Greek tragedy and Greek epic, particularly tragedy, as popular entertainment. You didn't dress up, as Ken would have put it, to go to a Greek play in ancient Athens. You went, you spent the whole day there, you ate your food, you saw four plays in one day. You threw food at the actors if you didn't like them. There was a competition. People shouted. They yelled. It was much closer to a rock concert or a philosophy.
Look, that makes me think that in 250, 300, 400, 500 years when they're studying the, quote, art of this period, it makes me think that the stuff that we think of as kind of the hoi polloi popular culture is the stuff that's going to survive rather than the high concept kind of art produced in academies and universities. Would you think of that? Do you think that's right?
Well, I think that probably both will survive. But think about it. For Plato, living 2,500 years ago, to say that Oedipus or Prometheus or Clytemnestra would one day be heroes of the culture or great, great figures in a culture 2,500 years away would be as ridiculous as it would be, it would sound as ridiculous to him as it would sound to us to say that George and Elaine and Kramer are going to be such characters 2,500 years from now. What will those people think of us?
Well, I mean, Plato probably would have been pretty upset to find that his book was required in the same syllabus with Aeschylus and all those guys in
exactly.
Stanford's freshman year. I'd be just thrilled to think that my works would be required along with Seinfeld reruns in a couple hundred years.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about What is Art with Alexander Nehemias from Princeton University. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134 or outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Raul in Novato is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Raul.
Thank you. This is a very interesting discussion, and it reminds me of the fact that in most primitive cultures, there is no such thing as a concept of art, and yet all those objects, those baskets, those masks, and all those other wonderful things end up in our museums and are labeled as art. And my comment is that I feel that the thing that we call art doesn't really have any boundaries. So in essence, by attempting to limit it or to define it, we are in the process not necessarily of destroying it, but I don't believe it's a fruitful endeavor.
Thanks, Ro. What do you think, Alexander? It's not fruitful to try and define art.
Well, we don't want to be run out of our own business, so I think I'll insist that, you know, there is something very interesting and important, but I think Raoul is absolutely right. You have to be very careful if you're trying to define something, not to leave things out. And that, I think, is where, again, the problems come. But in trying to define art, I think we understand various things that art does. So in that sense, trying to define it, in other words, trying to understand it, not necessarily coming up with a little formula that will solve the problem of what is and what isn't art. I mean, after all, why exactly would we want that? We need to think about that, too. Is a very interesting and actually fruitful endeavor.
It worries me that the category of art is so disunified. And art is a kind of honorific term. If I call something art, it honors it in some ways.
That's true.
Some of the stuff that falls in the category, I got to say, you know, the blank white canvas or the all black, the subtle all black, I admit that there's a lot of subtlety there. And still, it doesn't visually arrest me. It doesn't aesthetically, sensually arrest. I like art that takes over my senses, takes over my consciousness, and then maybe makes me think. But art that doesn't do that, and there's a lot of it that doesn't do that, I don't know why we call it art. It's just, I just don't know what we're getting at when we call it art.
Well, Ken, you just said that there's some things that you like. You want art to be to consist of things that you like. Well, what if other people do like the black and the white paintings? Mm-hmm. Are they just wrong? Are they less good at it than you are? Or should we, so to speak, respect their own tastes? I think that's a serious question.
Well, I think it's a serious question, but then there's no unity to it, you know? I mean, what unifies it? What makes it, you know?
I don't think there's all that much that unifies it, but I do think that by and large, I think it was Larry who said before something about a bright idea being embodied in a material. I think to some extent that's what we are looking for. A bright idea, it doesn't necessarily have to be intelligent, but it can be imaginative or sensitive or whatever.
Mark in Sonoma is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark.
Thank you. You know, I was thinking one time I heard John Lennon say that he could write a song if he had to, but he really preferred it when he got an inspiration. And many artists will say that they do their best work when they are transcribing some inspiration. And then the other idea I have with that is Carl Jung's idea of the unconscious and the collective unconscious. And he said that an artist produces his best work when he takes himself out of the picture. And I think that the reason why art communicates to other people on this unconscious level is because on Jung's ideas, we have like a collective unconscious, and an artist is able to get to that first and then produce something out of it to where it'll be triggered by the work in other people.
Thanks, Mark. What do you think, Alexander?
Well, I think the idea, the quote from John Lennon was terrific because it brings us back to what in your roving reporter's report you had saying that I could have done that. And we pass that by as if it's obvious, and that's true. I don't think so at all. I don't think you could have done it. I think, first of all, when people say that, at best what they could have done was to copy the thing in question. That's what they mean. They mean that I don't see the technique or the craft in it. It's not true that you could have done it, because if you could have done it, you probably would have done it. Why wouldn't you if you were able to do that? The idea is that we see something that looks very simple. We don't realize how much work, and the work doesn't always have to be craft, has gone into it. And we see the final product only. We see the surface of it. And then we say, I could have done it. It's not true. Picasso once made a sculpture of an ape by using a Volkswagen, a model Volkswagen, as the head of the ape. Obvious when you think about it. Any old Volkswagen bug could look like a could look like an ape if you put it there. But it took a great eye to be able to see it that way. And I think that is very important.
You know, people have been pretty, some of our callers, pretty skeptical about definition. So I looked up the definition of art. I think it's pretty pretty substantial and insightful. This is from the simple dictionary that comes with my Macintosh. It says, the expression or application of human creative skill and imagination, typically in a visual form, such as painting or sculpture, producing works to be appreciated primarily for their beauty or emotional power. Now, that does pretty well at getting at least kind of at the paradigm. So I agree with what Alexander said before. The definitions may not be totally successful, but working at them really can be quite productive and helpful.
But that pleasure thing, you know, that's – I like beautiful stuff. I like nature. Unlike Alexander, I remember you don't – like trees so much.
I don't like trees at all. It's true.
Yeah, but I like beautiful things. I like beautiful looking people. I like beautiful scenery. I like beautiful art. But I think in the 20th century, you know, art doesn't necessarily strive to be beautiful. It strives to like arrest you in some ways.
Well, the definition says beauty or emotional power. So
yeah,
that's kind of a...
Yeah. So what's the connection between beauty and art?
Well, the connection between beauty and art is really important. I'm in the middle of trying to think about that. And what I'd like to say is the following. Look, we think of beauty and we generally think of looking good, of, if you want to put it that way, prettiness. But not all beauty is prettiness, though I think that it always involves prettiness. I think modernist arts, the arts that actually cause people to be so upset about what art is and whether things are art or not, aimed to produce, as they saw it, works that were not beautiful. What they produced were works that were not good-looking. They were not pretty. But beauty is not a matter of what something looks like. Beauty is a matter of whether you love the object or not. And works that may look very ugly to Ken, for example, may be works that John or somebody else might very much love or like, at least.
Hey.
And if you think of beauty that way, then the issues change.
I think Anne's on my side. Anne in San Francisco's on my
All
side
right.
in this one. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anne.
And then dial your operator.
Oh, did we just lose Anne? Anne, you're gone. So Steve and Hayward's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve.
Hi. Great show, as always. I just want to say that I think the whole... you know, distinction between high and low art is a completely specious one. You know, I mean, art is in the ear, eye, whatever of the beholder, and good and bad is in the ear, eye, whatever of the beholder. And, you know, symphony, opera, ballet is high art, punk rock, Andy Warhol is low art. No, that's limited thinking and, in fact, quite antithetical in my mind to the whole conception of art, which should be something very open and free-flowing and, you know, positive. So making these distinctions, I just think, is wrong and just totally antithetical to art.
Yeah, okay. Alexander, I'll let you respond to that after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our question, what is art? With us from Princeton University is Alexander Nehemas.
We've been talking about the nature of art, high art, low art, in-between art. When we return, we'll ask about the function of art and see if we can come up with a more positive account than the kind of negative one that Plato came up with.
Questions about the nature of art, along with more of your calls and emails, when Philosophy Talk continues.
NCC, an art for art's sake. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're asking, what is art? And we're going to turn to the question, what is the purpose or function of art? What do we as individuals get out of it? What does society get out of it? Tell us what you think. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Alexander Nehemas from Princeton University. Alexander, I want to do a thought experiment for you, because I want to figure out what is art for. And one way to figure out what something is for is to think, what would be lacking in the absence of it? So suppose there was no art. How would life be worse off? How would society be worse off? Or would we be worse off? Would society be worse off? What does art do for us?
Well, the obvious thing that it does for us, at least much of art does for us, is to give us enjoyment and to entertain us. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think that very often people who take the arts seriously like to pretend that they're not enjoying themselves when they are looking
well,
or listening.
That's because some of the stuff they're listening to.
Well, that... No. Ken.
I'm just teasing.
But, well... some art is intended not to provide entertainment, and that's true. And I think that, generally speaking, it fails in the long run. But I think that entertainment and enjoyment are extraordinarily important sort of aspects of life. And without them, I mean, think about it. You'd have no television, you'd have no painting, you'd have no music. But we're not just talking about Bach, right? We're talking about John Lennon, we're talking about rap music, too, because they are parts of the musical world of art as well. So, believe me, there'd be very little to do without art.
Anne, who had a question about modern art, is back, I think. Anne, are you there?
Oh, hello.
Oh, yeah. What's your comment or question?
I was thinking that it might be modern art that has destroyed any concept of art, because the modern art is really not good, so much of it, and they're passing anything off as art, and they must, you know, they should not do that to us, because we know that there have been standards of art throughout the centuries. And there are degrees of art, and there's subject matter. There's a whole study of art. The subject matter goes, you know, like, for instance, spiritual art is certainly higher than still art or animals. And so there's also the content and the skill of the artist.
Anne, let me ask you, what is it that you think is wrong with modern art? You say it's not good. You mean it's not creative? There's no technique? And what are you saying?
Well, some of it's incoherent. It doesn't have a message. It's even unnamed. One of the aspects of art is that it expresses truth and it expresses beauty and it expresses the fine skill and workmanship of the person. That's why they can have those baskets and things, because the fine workmanship was there. And it was so it doesn't matter what it was. Like architecture is also art, and some dance, and painting and sculpture, of course, and writing. So there's a whole subject field of art. So they're really denying it when they say that anything should be art, because anything is not art.
Anne, thanks for the call. Alexander, Anne has some strong views about what should and shouldn't be art. What do you think about those strong views?
I absolutely agree with Anne that it's not the case that anything should be art. We definitely don't. I think nobody believes that, not even the people who think that the limits and the borders of art are very, very flexible. It's very difficult for something to become a work of art. It's not at all easy to convince somebody to buy it, and especially to buy it is very expensive, and then give it to a museum. Now, of course, there's status involved. Naturally, there's status involved. What do we think? Do we think that Louis XIV didn't think there was status involved in his commissioning, you know, 35,000 portraits of him? There's always status involved.
A vain man.
You know, and all those bishops and electors in Germany with their court composers, and Mozart and Bach having to write. Bach had to write a cantata every Sunday for I don't know how many years. You know, every week you had to produce a new one because the elector didn't like to hear the same one again.
But I think Anne's getting at something else, though, Alexander. I don't know if she'd put it this way, but our curator in Polly Stryker's piece mentioned something about the beginning viewer.
Right.
And
right.
A lot of art is inaccessible. On first encounter, it is just really inaccessible, and it requires a tremendous kind of background knowledge of a certain scene and all this stuff. And somehow people think art should be more immediately arresting, I think.
Well, you know, if going back to the dictionary definition, if beauty or more emotional effect, emotional power, is one of the key aims of art, then it makes sense that you might have some works of art that had a very select audience, just as you have some works of philosophy that have a very select audience.
Exactly.
I mean, I can well imagine that some of the pieces of art that I don't quite get, I'm just not attuned to the set of emotions that the artist was after and the circumstances in which they would be aroused.
I understand that, but there's this fear of it degenerating into an insider's game. What do you think about that, Alexander?
Well, some of it is an insider's game, and I'm not trying to say that's a good or a bad thing for that matter, but let me turn the question around a little bit. We think that it's very easy to appreciate beautiful art, and yet I think if we were extremely honest with ourselves and thought back to many, many of our visits to various museums or churches or whatever it is where we see art, one of the most common reactions that we will remember is boredom. I think people go through museums, they take a look at the Botticelli here, they move on, they look a bit at the Da Vinci there, and they know they should like it, but they don't really know what to like. Now, that's not, the curator said beginning viewers, like most of the public, and it's probably true. You need to look a lot in order to appreciate. But museums don't help us.
Yeah. Dave.
They don't help us.
Dave from Berkeley is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave. Dave, are you there? I keep losing callers.
I want to agree with Alexander that my when I think about museums, I think about having a sore back.
Yes.
But I suppose if most of them had wooden floors or cork, that might help me a lot. But my favorite painting is Caravaggio's Abraham and Isaac. I just think it's a wonderful painting. I don't know if you could call it beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. And the reason I like it is he seems to have gotten the maniacal look that you would think Abraham would have in the utterly scared, blankless, bleepless look that you would expect his son to have in that situation. But most of the paintings in museums are, you know, kind of boring, or you can kind of see why somebody would have commissioned a huge wall-like painting about that battle, but I don't even know where the battle was and stuff like that, boring as can be.
About Caravaggio, it's very interesting that, of course, when he was painting, he was considered terribly vulgar, because instead of having very sophisticated and refined figures be his Virgin Mary or his Abraham, for that matter, he had ordinary people model for him. And that was supposed to be very, very not right.
So look, you guys are both... Go ahead, Alexander.
I want to say something that really matters to me. A few months ago, there was a show last year at the Museum of Modern Art in New York about Pizarro and Cézanne. They were both great Impressionist painters, and Cézanne, post-Impressionist as well. They spent years painting together. They would go together to a place, set up their easel, and paint the same scene. So they had a show where they showed pictures that they had painted at the same time of the same scene. And it was amazing, because for once in a museum, everybody was talking to everyone else, because people could see how many decisions one has to make in order to produce a picture. How different two people who are really of the same school, the same period, the same approach to art, how differently they see and paint things. And at that point, you start realizing how the process that has to go into the painting. Otherwise, we look at those great paintings one after the other. We don't realize how much better they are than the others. And I think comparison, the ability to say this was done this way for this reason, as opposed to that one over there, which was done another way for another reason, is absolutely essential. And without the ability to compare, I think we miss a tremendous amount of art.
No, I take your point, and that goes back to your point that museums, as currently constituted, often don't help us, because you're making the point that we have to learn to look at these things, right? That just as there's a skill in producing, there's also a kind of skill in consuming, and we don't often get the chance to acquire that skill.
And, you know, the same is true of all the arts, including television. I mean, you can't just turn the set on and start appreciating, or for that matter, condemning what you see. You need to learn how to watch. It's not like watching a movie. It's not like reading a novel. There are other criteria, other standards, and that's what people learn.
Can the artist do anything independent of the museum or the exhibitor to help us see into what he or she intends or wants us to see?
Well, it is a matter of exhibition. I think I think this is a matter for museums and curators. They need to be able to place things in a context where you can see what it was that somebody was trying to do, that somebody else was trying to do also, and how one succeeded and the other failed, or how two people tried to do different things but came out with things that look alike. I think that's where it is. The artists themselves, I think, just produce the work. That's their responsibility.
Yeah. So, Alexander, and then I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. It's been a real pleasure having you with us.
Always mine.
Our guest has been Alexander Naamos, professor of the humanities, philosophy, and comparative literature at Princeton University, author of many, many books, including The Art of Living, Socratic Reflections from Plato to Foucault, and he's currently working on a book on beauty, I understand.
Thanks so much to Alexander for joining us. You know, I always say thanks to the callers and emails we didn't get a chance to get to, but today we really had a lot of calls and a lot of emails, a lot of very thoughtful emails that we just couldn't get to all of them. So thanks a lot. It really, sometimes we can capture some of your ideas in a question of our own, And we do really appreciate knowing what people are thinking about.
Yeah, so thanks a lot, guys. So, John, where's your head about art today? Are you enlightened?
Oh, you can't talk to two bright people like you and Alexander without learning a little bit. I have two levels of reaction about the main problem we were considering, which was modern visual arts. And one is kind of my kid from Nebraska reaction. Oh, come on, get off it, all black, all white piece of art, just rich people fooling themselves. And I think there's some validity in that. I think a lot of it probably is a commercially driven semi-scam. On the other hand, if you think about people's reaction to philosophy and they expect it to be something it has grown out of being. It's still something that's accessible to a lot of people and deals with basic problems. It's also become very professionalized, and some of it is very obscure to all but a few specialists. And I had no reason art shouldn't be the same.
Yeah, I that's right. But art isn't just, unlike philosophy, that technical specialized philosophy is mostly addressed to other philosophers. But art is not just addressed to other artists. It's addressed to us, right? And so it should be, in some ways, be accessible to us. I mean, I don't know. I think Anne had a lot of opinions about modern art. I don't share all of them. But one of the things I think modern art has done is made itself not accessible to lots of people, right? And I think that's a problem. I think art's cool and we can get lots out of it, but I think that's a problem. But anyway, this conversation continues, we promise, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Today, we'll give the last word on art to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Jacques-Louis David was one of the first artists whose art reflected his own zealous personal beliefs. Beliefs, however, that shifted radically with each political wind. He wound up being a court painter, if you will, to Louis XVI, the French Revolution, and Napoleon Bonaparte. As a young artist, David helped create what is called the neoclassical style, a strong reaction to the frivolous Rococo art of the early 18th century, the decorative style favored by decadent aristocrats. Neoclassicism created a new cult of Stoicism and civic virtue, as his paintings turned attention back to ancient Greeks and Romans with huge, stagey pictures like his The Death of Socrates and Brutus. King Louis XVI was the first buyer of his work. Then came the Revolution. David bought into it totally, without, however, surrendering his classical point of view. Only instead of painting Greeks and Romans in classical tableaus as role models, he began painting the French in classical tableaus. He hooked up Jean-Paul Marat, a very nasty piece of work. A failed physician and scientist, Marat had turned to polemic, urging death to aristocrats as well as its ideological rivals. One of those rivals, Charlotte Corday, stabbed him in his bathtub and was later guillotined for her act. Before she died, she said, "I killed one man to save 100,000. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. In one of his most famous paintings, The Death of Marat, David makes Marat appear angelic and serene as he breathes his last in his tub. This painting had the effect of turning Marat into a martyr, this helping to launch the reign of terror Charlotte Corday had hoped to avoid. David himself became a leader in the revolution. He called for the death of Louis XVI, causing his royalist wife to divorce him in disgust. David himself signed the warrants for hundreds to be guillotined. Late in the revolutionary turmoils, David was imprisoned, but released on the plea of his wife, and they were remarried in 1796. He painted Intervention of the Sabine Women to thank her, so it said. This painting can be the attention of Napoleon, who made him his official painter. It is from David that we get the official look of Napoleon with the hand in the vest. David once said, again revealing his Greco-Roman fetish, "My friends, what a beautiful head he has. It is simple, great, beautiful, like a head from antiquity." After the fall of Napoleon, David ended his days exiled in Belgium. So, Jacques-Louis David's paintings wound up having a powerful, emotional, and intellectual appeal to aristocrats, revolutionaries, and Bonaparte himself, all of whom, strangely, seem to find the same thing in his paintings, a notion of themselves as heroic figures caught in a dramatic moment of history. So is he an artist or a suck-up to the powers that be, a propagandist or a genius, a moral monster or just another schmuck caught in the coils of history? And what are the viewers of his paintings, self-deluded fools or enlightened aesthetes? Well, I don't know. I've always liked that Marat painting, though. It's a lie, all right, but it's beautiful. I gotta go.
That was Ian Scholes, Digging Deep, Digging Fast, the 60-Second Philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rugenshi, Neil Van Loon, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley, and to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.